I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. 12 years into its school choice program, Baltimore City's public school system is still short of its goal of providing access to advanced academic opportunities to all students, regardless of where they live or their family's income. That is the finding of a new report by the Fund for Educational Excellence, a Baltimore nonprofit that promotes equity in the city's schools. We're going to spend the next hour examining the reasons why school choice hasn't yet fulfilled its promise with the fund's CEO, Roger Schulman, along with Taylor Stewart, a teacher and advocate with Leadership for Educational Equity, and Nicole Hannah-Jones, an award-winning investigative journalist with the New York Times Magazine, whose work has explored the impact of race and income on the quality of our nation's educational system. That's Midday, right after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in today for Tom Hall. More than a decade ago, Baltimore City's public school system launched an ambitious program. It's called School Choice. And here's what it does. It gives all students and their parents a chance to participate in the selection of the middle schools and high schools that they want to attend. The annual High School Choice Program, it starts each fall. It goes on through the spring, and it gives late middle schoolers an opportunity to identify their top five preferred high schools. Kids make these selections based on a whole range of criteria. They look at student population, gender mix, sports programs, and, of course, special academic offerings like advanced placement courses and college credit curricular tracks. Here's what the studies show and what's going to be at the heart of our conversation today on Midday. The chance to enroll in a high school that offers rigorous college-level content can be a determining factor in whether or not a student goes on to a four-year college. Acceptance at so-called academic entrance criteria high schools, and we're going to talk about what that means in a few minutes. Acceptance at these schools can depend very heavily on whether or not a student scored well in advanced courses during his or her middle school years. One of the stated intentions of the City School Choice Program to create better educational opportunities for the city's lower-income students. So today, on this radio program, we're going to ask, how's that been going? An independent report released last month has an answer to the question. It concludes that the school choice program remains well short of its goals and that high school enrollment in Baltimore City is still very much strongly tied to income. It found that lower-income students' attendance at college-track high schools is roughly half the rate of higher-income students. The report is titled Calculated Choices, Equity, and Opportunity in Baltimore City Public Schools. It was commissioned by the Fund for Educational Excellence. That's a Baltimore-based nonprofit that is supporting efforts to increase student achievement in the city's public schools. The fund's president and CEO, Roger Schulman, joins me in studio this afternoon to discuss the report's findings and their implications for academic equity in the city's public school system. Mr. Schulman moved to Baltimore two decades ago as a part of the first Teach for America Corps to serve in Baltimore City public schools. He served as executive director for Teach for America and most recently as a senior partner with the New Teacher Project. Roger Schulman, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to have you with us. Joining me also in the studio is Taylor Stewart. Taylor Stewart is the Baltimore Regional Director at Leadership for Educational Equity. That is a nonprofit education policy and teacher training group. And their goal is a quality, equitable education for every Maryland student. Ms. Stewart has spent the past 10 years working as a teacher and an advocate for academic equity in schools all across the city and the state. Taylor Stewart, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line with us from the Manhattan studio of the New York Times is Nicole Hannah-Jones. If you have not heard of her, I will tell you that she is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, and she has reported powerfully on the issue of race and opportunity in America's public schools. She won a 2016 Peabody Award for her series on school segregation for the public radio program This American Life, and her story last year for the New York Times Magazine, Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City, recently won her the Hillman Prize for Magazine Journalism. Nicole Hannah-Jones, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Of course.
Glad to have you with us. So we also, of course, want to invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation on equity and opportunity in Baltimore City's public schools. Are Baltimore's low-income students getting the kind of choices the city has been promising them for the past 12 years? Are race and class still barriers to a quality public school education in America? Are your kids in the city schools? Have you and your child been through this process, the school choice process? What's working? What's not working about this system? Give us a call with your thoughts, your stories. The number to call, 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org or send a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Okay, so Nicole, I want to give you an opportunity, Nicole, up in New York, to begin perhaps by setting the table for our conversation historically. So we're all on the same page, us and our listeners, as we set out here. This report on school choice here in Baltimore is really obviously just the latest chapter in a much longer, bigger story about a promise that was made back in 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Ed case. Let me give you the floor here at the top of the hour to walk us through some of the legal and cultural tug of war that's followed in the wake of the Brown versus Board of Ed decision nationwide. Talk about maybe how close we actually got to the promise of school integration in the 1980s, and then the relative unraveling, I guess you could say, that's happened since then.
Sure. I'll try to do that in a few minutes. So last week was the 63rd anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, and most listeners are aware that that is the Supreme Court case that struck down legally mandated school segregation. And the way that history is kind of commonly believed is the court rules and America understands the ill of its ways, and we embark on this period of busing, and busing was really bad, and it was really hard, and so we had to give up, but we tried really hard. The truth is, this country never wanted school desegregation. There was massive resistance across the South. There was resistance across the North, sometimes violent, sometimes not. Most school districts actually never used busing as a form of desegregation, but busing became kind of this red herring that allowed us to say this was too difficult. When the courts began ordering school desegregation, mostly across the South, but also in the North as well, it actually worked. And 1988 was the peak of school integration in this country. And what we know is at that peak, that was when the achievement gap between black and white students was the narrowest. And it actually closed very rapidly once this country took seriously the mandate of Brown to integrate its schools. But it was a very short period. It was not even a generation. And starting in 1988, we began to walk away from these court orders and from efforts to integrate schools. And we've seen a resegregation. Today, black students in this country are more segregated than at any period since 1972. And they are now facing a double segregation, which we see very clearly in Baltimore, where students are segregated both by race and class. And we've seen the achievement gap widen. And with all of these different school reforms that we've seen across the country over the last 20 years, none of them have narrowed the achievement gap to the point that school integration did. And I guess the only other thing I would mention is we need to be clear there was never a point where we saw wide-scale voluntary integration. School choice programs actually arose out of the efforts to fight desegregation. They were originally called freedom of choice plans, and now they're called school choice plans, but they still function largely the same way, which is to provide the best educational opportunities for white and middle-class children.
Nicole Hannah-Jones in New York, thank you for setting the table for us. And let me now turn to Roger Schulman and Taylor Stewart here in the studio. Let me have you guys pick up the baton here and talk about where the history that we just heard connects with us here in Baltimore. What does our public school landscape look like? How segregated are our schools? And what are the problems that that Baltimore's school choice program set out to try to alleviate 12 years ago? I see you guys looking at each other. Who's going to start? Taylor is motioning to Roger. Go ahead, Roger.
Sure. Thank you. it's important when talking about school choice in Baltimore to think a little bit about the population of student who is attending public schools in Baltimore City Public Schools. So right now in Baltimore, about 85% of students are African American. For the first time this year, Latino students are the second largest group of students in the school system, with white students following behind. And we have a very, very high percentage of students in Baltimore City Public Schools who live in poverty. When it was being calculated the way most school districts do, by looking at students who receive free and reduced meals, about 85% of the students in our school system were receiving free and reduced meals. And when you compare Baltimore, at least to the rest of the state, we are serving three times as many students who live in extreme poverty as any other jurisdiction in the state. So it's important when you talk about school choice in the Baltimore context, you look at the overall population of student who attends. And what school choice was meant to do about 10 years ago, a little more when it was started here, was to give every student the opportunity to attend a school that was more academically rigorous, had programming that was better aligned to the interests of the student, and to say to families that if the school in your neighborhood has been chronically failing children for decades, you are not, because you can't move somewhere else, relegated to have to use that school.
Taylor Stewart, let me have you pick up from there. The population of students in Baltimore, the challenges they face, and the hope and promise of school choice.
Absolutely. I think the other statistic that always stands out to me is the amount of students in Baltimore who are in concentrated poverty. So on top of the large farms population that we used to have, it is additionally that very nearly like a quarter of our students in our schools also live in concentrated poverty, which at that sort of point, the needs of kids and in communities are incredibly pronounced in certain areas of our city. And that goes along with the needs of communities around lots of other issues, such as housing and in transit and then government services. And we see those kind of most pronounced in areas in West Baltimore and in East Baltimore. And so I do think that at the beginning of that school choice conversation, it was knowing that there were all of these other systemic issues across the city affecting those kids, and so trying to kind of think through an opportunity to provide other ways of getting a quality education. But what we've seen is that people tend to go to school where they live. And so where we see those concentrations of poverty and where we see those concentrations of low-income families, and most of those are predominantly minority families, we don't tend to see the same options and quality options for kids to go to school.
Listeners, I want to invite you again into the conversation. The number to call this hour, 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, to take part in this conversation about school choice. And a sidebar here, if you guys help us out here. School choice can be a bit of a confusing term, especially these days. We're hearing a lot about the term school choice nationally as pertains to vouchers. Let me maybe by way of making a distinction here, have you tell the story of the school choice program as it was created here in Baltimore, what it means for this city. It's not about vouchers.
It is not about vouchers. When we're talking about school choice in Baltimore for the sake of our report or in the general conversation about school choice, we are talking about Baltimore City Public Schools, which does include the charter schools. And it is important to note that in Maryland, with our charter law, that charter schools are a part of the district in the same way that any other school is. So when we talk about school choice here, we are talking about a family's option to choose any public school inside of Baltimore City.
Let's talk about how it does work then, and has more or less for the past decade. Talk about maybe that sort of annual ritual, the steps of the school choice process as Baltimore City middle schoolers experience it toward the end of their middle school career.
Sure. So I think it's important when we talk about the steps, one of the things we heard in our report is the steps can look different depending on the school you're at and the information a child receives. And I think that's a really important piece of what we heard from students and families when we spoke to them. Ideally, the way the program works is that sometime in late fall, usually October, things come out, a big document called the School Choice Guide, and students and their families start thinking about what high school the student would like to attend. And a lot of things can drive those decisions. So academic criteria high schools, schools where you have to have the grades and the test scores to be able to get in. Interest areas, if you're interested in the medical arts or cosmetology or mechanics, there are different options that are available to you. And in a city like Baltimore, part of what we heard is that geography matters a lot. What schools can a student get to via public transportation relatively easily? The safety of the neighborhood matters a lot. But all of these things come into play. And in December, students pick five choices, their top five choices. And then around a little over a month ago, students receive the answer as to where they are going to go to high school. And that can be based on a lot of different criteria. So it's a several-month process that ultimately determines where a student goes to high school.
Could I add something here?
Sure. That's Nicole in New York.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's just important to be very clear about what school choice means, because I think it sounds very alluring. And when we say that school choice is about giving every student access to rigorous curriculum and better schools, no matter where they live or their income, that sounds very good. But we know that that's not actually how it works. School choice is built on some schools are good and some schools are bad, and we need to give kids access to those good schools. The problem is there are a limited number of those schools, and often the best schools have criteria that automatically excludes large segments of the population. When you're not getting choice until eighth grade, you've spent then from kindergarten till eighth grade in schools that we know are segregated and that are not providing the proper preparation to get into the best schools. That's why when you look at the data, you see that white students and high-income students are concentrated in a handful of schools, which also are the high-performing schools. So I think, school choice gets sold on this premise that every kid will have access. Every kid can't have access in a system with a limited number of high-performing schools. Just a small number of those kids are going to get access to that. And I think that is critical. That's what we're seeing here, and that's what we're seeing across the country.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, you make an important point there. And I think as we get into the text of this report and its findings, we're going to find that it, in fact, bears out exactly what you're saying. A lot to unpack here about this report: Calculated Choices, Equity, and Opportunity in Baltimore City Public Schools, a report put out recently by the Fund for Educational Excellence. Roger Shulman is from that organization. He's here in studio with us. Taylor Stewart, Regional Director in Baltimore at Leadership for Educational Equity, with us as well. And joining us from Manhattan, staff writer for the New York Times, Nicole Hannah-Jones. 410-662-8780, the number to call to join the conversation. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow on the program, guest host Rob Sivak is going to be spending the hour with McKay Jenkins, an environmental writer, a professor of journalism at the University of Delaware, and the author of seven books. His latest book, Food Fight, GMOs, and the Future of the American Diet. They'll examine the controversy over genetically modified foods and how, for better or worse, this biotechnology has transformed the American food industry. That is tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us now, we are discussing the findings of a new report by the Fund for Educational Excellence. The Baltimore nonprofit's report is titled Calculated Choices, Equity, and Opportunity in Baltimore City Public Schools. And spoiler alert, here is what the summary says. School choice in Baltimore has yet to fulfill its promise. There remains a relative lack of access to advanced academic programs for our lowest income students. Joining us here in studio is Roger Shulman. He's the head of the Fund for Educational Excellence, the group that published that report. We're also joined by Taylor Stewart. She has been a school teacher and education advocate. She now serves as the Baltimore Regional Director at Leadership for Educational Equity, a nonprofit policy group. And here with us on the line from the New York Times studio in Manhattan is Nicole Hannah-Jones. She is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, who has written about race and equity in America's public schools. You heard Nicole Hannah-Jones making some important points at the end of our last segment, and we're now going to get into the meat of this report here locally that is going to bear out some of what Nicole aptly pointed out at the end of our last segment. As the representative of the group that published this report, I turn to you now, Roger, and ask you to say a few words about the goals of this report and its methodologies. What did you want to find out, and how did you go about getting your information?
Sure. So the Fund for Educational Excellence has been putting out reports like this for the last several years. Our last report was about college readiness and how students and families perceived college readiness in Baltimore area high schools. And that report and what we heard from students and parents led us to think more about how families were choosing the school the student attended, because there seems to be a very clear relationship between the high school a student attends and the likelihood of that student being able to attend college. So we wanted to be able to understand from kids and families how they chose schools, which is why we made this the report we spent the last year working on. And the way that we did this, and really important for us, is to go hear from the students and families who use our public schools. I spend a lot of time in conference rooms all over the city thinking about big issues related to education, but understanding from the families and the students who use our schools how they experience it is very, very important to us. So we have, with this report, just as we have for our others, identified neighborhoods throughout the city where we want to go hear from families. And we identify what we call a conversation host, who is someone who lives in the neighborhood, who people know. It can be a church leader. It can be a parent that everybody knows. And that person invites people to attend. And then we bring in a facilitator to have the conversation with the host present. And we record those conversations. Everyone knows they're being recorded. And then we go through a qualitative analysis of transcribing every conversation we had, coding the conversations, and then identifying the themes we hear based on how often we heard that theme.
And these are hundreds of conversations, 400-plus conversations from all over the city.
That's right. We heard from 418 participants in this report from all over Baltimore City.
Taylor Stewart, you are familiar with this report. You've had a look at it. Talk about what you see in this report, what you see in these conversations and the themes that have come out of them.
Absolutely. I think that the report bears out a lot of what people observe in Baltimore, but I thought one of the most, I think, kind of startling numbers that kind of brought me out was the distribution of the schools with the special academic programming. And seeing that 19 of those programs are located in our highest median income areas, where we're serving only about 3,000 kids, and then in our lowest income areas in Baltimore, where there's nearly 6,000 children, we have about 8 of those programs. I think that that number and looking at that graph was incredibly stark. As far as the themes, I think that many of them kind of rely on themes that we heard in the previous fund reports of the relationships that are happening in schools, and that parents want kind of deep relationships and high academic achievement for their students in schools, and the desire for safe places for their kids to be able to go to school. And I think that what is always interesting whenever you do a report that is based on conversations is that all of the things that people know that they want for their kids, those things are true across income levels. We want safe, high academic achieving, caring school environments for our kids. And I think that this report bears that out. But it's really important in our city to state it, and then to also dovetail that with the numbers that show that we are not equitably providing, especially that academic achievement, to all kids.
Roger Schulman from the Fund for Educational Excellence. Let me turn back to you now and have you share some of the findings. Some of the you've got interesting pages and pages of interesting poll quotes from folks from these conversations, and you have, as you say, used some quantitative analysis to break into some specific themes. Talk about the top themes that really sort of rose to the top here after these hundreds of conversations.
Sure, there were, when we look at the themes we heard most often, they fall into two categories. generally it was talking about what families want in a school, and then it was talking about how they interact with the process of choice, the administrative process. So to Taylor's point, what families want are what most families want for their kids. They want a school that they talked a lot about, schools that feel good when you enter it, that has an environment that you want to be in, where the principal, and we heard a ton about the teachers and how important the teacher is and the connection that students feel with the teacher. And they talked about teachers in two important ways: teachers who have high expectations for them academically and teachers who care about them as people. And the fact that we are hearing so many students and families saying, I do want a teacher who's going to push me academically, but I need them to understand who I am as a person, was really important. As Taylor also mentioned, we heard a lot about safety and wanting to feel safe both inside the building, in the neighborhood where the building exists, and on their way to and from school. And then what we heard a ton about was the process of choice. And some families feeling like they have all the information they need, they understand how the process works, they figure out a way to go visit schools and determine the school that's best for them. And way too many of the families we spoke to said they don't really understand it, that it's a bit of a black box that they don't know how to navigate. And they're very reliant on someone in the school helping them to be able to do that. So to the point Nicole was making earlier, families with great social capital can figure out a way to navigate choice in a way that benefits their student or their child. And families without that struggle to end up in schools that are most likely going to benefit their child.
Let me have you say just a little bit more about this. And this is something that Nicole Hannah-Jones mentioned at the end of our last segment as well. And that is schools with academic entrance criteria. Explain the difference between those schools choosing to try to get into one of those schools versus other schools that you might put on your list of five choices.
Sure. So if you are from Baltimore, you are probably very familiar with schools like City College, Poly, Western. Those are schools that you can enter, but it is based solely on something called a composite score, which is comprised of a formula of your grades, your attendance, and standardized test scores. And those come from a student's seventh grade year and the first quarter of a student's eighth grade year. And to enter one of those academic criteria high schools, it is based solely on your composite score. So if you have a high composite score, then you have all the choice in the world. If you do not have a composite score that would make you eligible for one of those schools, then your choices become somewhat limited. And again, we heard this over and over again from parents, that their child gets reduced to their composite score. And to the point, because this is important for the academic criteria schools, to the point Taylor was making earlier, if you have access to an advanced academic program in middle school, as Taylor said, 19 programs in our highest income neighborhoods, 8 in our lowest income neighborhoods, not only is there an equity issue there about access to rigor, advanced academic grades are weighted in the composite score so that if you can take an advanced academic class, your grade in that class counts more than the same grade in a class that is not advanced academic. So our poorest kids not only don't have access to the rigor, which unto itself has value, they are then hit again with the composite score.
So again, what we're seeing here is where we have a schism between the selling points and the good intentions of a program and the logistical sort of more invisible bumps in the road when the rubber hits the road. Nicole Hannah-Jones, you've been hearing these descriptions of the program, of its intentions here in Baltimore, and of some of the problems that the Fund for Educational Excellence has pointed out. How does this school choice program in Baltimore compare to efforts in other cities around the country?
I mean, it's very similar to what we see across the country, and I would actually push back against this narrative that the program is not operating as designed and that these are unintended consequences or bumps in the road. I think you can look at how the system is designed, and it's designed to produce what it is producing. It is not an accident that the most rigorous schools and curriculum are concentrated in high-income areas. even though those serve a smaller number of students. It is not by accident that getting into these choice schools is part of a system that is very difficult to navigate if you are not college educated, middle class, who have a lot of time on your hands. These were decisions that someone made, and I think we see this all across the country. You have a school system, when you implement choice, what you are saying is we are going to have good schools and bad schools, and we're going to try to give the quote-unquote deserving students an exit from the bad schools. But you have to ask yourself, in a school system, who is in charge with ensuring that bad schools are not bad? And why are you limiting the number of schools that are quality and then having parents fight out getting access to those schools for their children? So when you look at choice programs all across the country, unless those choice programs are specifically built around integration, choice programs are almost always producing exactly what we see here. We see it in New York City. We see it in Chicago. You see it all over. Or what they end up doing is, I think what they are intended to do is to provide a reason for middle class and often a small number of white parents and black middle class parents to stay in a school system because they are going to get access to schools that don't reflect what the bulk of the schools in the district look like. So I just think we need to stop. We need to stop pretending that this is somehow incidental or accidental. It's producing what it's designed to produce.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, point well made and point taken. To borrow your phrase, carefully curated integration and its detriments, right? You make some, in some of your articles, you talk about the idea of the word diversity replacing the word integration.
Right.
And perhaps some underlying systemic issues that we need to uproot and pay more attention to. Let me go ahead and go to a couple of tweets here that have come in at midday. Let's see. Sabrina says, school choice is a wag-the-dog issue that allows governor, legislature, mayor, and city council to shirk responsibility. Hendrick says, wouldn't kids benefit if we improved all schools with choice plans? Some kids who cannot participate will be left behind. And then this is another tweet. It says, the issue of investment in local schools is not on parents or students. Budgets are statements of values by government. I want to go to the phones also at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, the number to call to join this conversation. And we turn now to Ryle in Towson. Ryle, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I started listening to your conversation, and immediately I looked up what students per capita were paying in different counties. Montgomery County is paying well over $1,000 less per student, and they're one of the top counties in the nation in education. So could be a spurious argument that we need different levels of schools, maybe more attention to every school.
Ryle, I hear your point loud and clear. Ryle saying, look at Montgomery County. It's cheaper. They're getting better results with a leaner budget. Let me go around the table and on the studio line as well and give you all a chance to respond to what you hear from Ryle. Taylor Stewart from Leadership for Educational Equity. I'll let you go ahead and start this.
I think that two issues were brought up in what Ryle said. I think that on one hand, Montgomery County does not engage in the same choice system and has invested across multiple schools. But I don't think that that necessarily kind of dovetails with the fact that they have a lower cost per pupil, because Montgomery County is just a more affluent county across the board in the students that they are serving. And so their schools don't necessarily have to provide for all of the needs that Baltimore City schools have to provide. That can include breakfast, lunch, dinner, all of the student support services, all of the services for a very large special needs population, and I can go on about those sorts of things. And also Montgomery County is facing some challenges on how to make sure that their low-income students and their minority students are also not being educated with the gaps and are getting the same quality education that all of the students and that more affluent students in Montgomery County are experiencing. So I think that that's right, that we do need a school portfolio that serves every child, and we need to be investing in a school portfolio that serves every child. And that's a state level issue. That's a city level issue of how we are investing our dollars to make sure that we do that. But we do need the additional funding for Baltimore City School students because of the concentrations of poverty and the far higher population of students with special needs.
From Taylor Stewart to Roger Shulman of the Fund for Educational Excellence.
I agree with a lot of what Taylor just said. So first of all, I think we can all agree having more good schools, quote unquote good schools, is what we all want. Every school should be great, and we should be sending our kids to great schools. I think conflating that with choice and looking at the demographics and population of the students who attend Montgomery County schools and the students who attend Baltimore City Public Schools makes that a challenging conversation. As Taylor laid out, the concentrated poverty in Baltimore City is profound. We have tens and dozens of schools where 99% of the kids are living in poverty, and what it takes to educate students who live in that kind of concentrated poverty is different. It is different, and that has to be considered when we look at the funding question.
Nicole Hannah-Jones in New York, you've heard this comment. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think we need to understand that equity and equality are not the same thing. So equality of funding is not going to produce the same results when you have one district, Montgomery County, which is not just one of the wealthiest in Maryland, it's actually one of the wealthiest in the country, versus Baltimore, which is a district that is almost entirely poor. The interesting thing about Montgomery County is Montgomery County has one of the few inclusionary zoning ordinances in the country, and it was the first inclusionary zoning ordinance in the country. And so what that means is low-income students are more evenly dispersed across schools because they're more evenly dispersed across neighborhoods. And therefore, low-income students in Montgomery County actually outperform low-income students in many other places because of that. What you have in the city of Baltimore is concentrated poverty and then a small number of schools with concentrated affluence, and you see very predictable results from that. So funding alone isn't going to fix those things.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. It is about time for another short break. I'll remind you the number to call, 410-662-8780. Michael in Baltimore and others, stand by. We'll get to your calls. Before we do head to this next break, it is our practice here on Midday each Monday to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and their friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has been compiling a list of Baltimore homicide victims for the past 15 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which the paper has been keeping since 2007. So far this year, 135 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 8 people were the victims of homicide in the city. They are Deshaunay Woodson, age 17, Tamez Lee, age 32, Brandon Lucas, age 26, Tyrell Williams, age 26, Kathy Schultz, age 58, Damontez Hudgen, age 20, Thomas Wyatt, age 48, and an unidentified man who was 47. You are listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall today. We're talking about academic equity in Baltimore City's public school system 12 years after the launch of the city's school choice program. With me in studio is Roger Shulman, CEO of the Fund for Educational Excellence. Their new report is titled Calculated Choices, Equity, and Opportunity in Baltimore City Public Schools. The report finds the city still has a lot of work to do to fulfill its promise to Baltimore's middle and high school students, a promise to bring them access to advanced academic programs and a path to college. Also with me in studio is Taylor Stewart. She is a teacher who now serves as the Baltimore Regional Director at Leadership for Educational Equity. That is a nonprofit policy group. And with us on the line, we're happy to have from the New York Times studio in Manhattan, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, who has written about how race issues have affected the quality of America's public schools. You are welcome to join the conversation. Do race and class still block some public school students from achieving their full academic potential? Let us know what you think. The number to call, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. The conversation is yours. Or you can email us at midday@wypr.org or send a tweet at @MiddayTomHall. So what do you say we head to the phones, guys, and hear what people have to say, what is on listeners' minds, and we'll go to Carrie in Baltimore. Carrie, you are on the air on Midday.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I find some of these foundation reports that are coming out on education flawed and somewhat disingenuous, because I think until you have public policy to support families in poverty, and that means job training for parents, mental health and drug counseling for parents, breakfast for the kids every day, after-school arts and music programs, you're never going to address the problem. So just attacking teachers or unions or the old system and saying you're going to disrupt this system because it's flawed glosses over the real underlying problems of how do we get children to come to school and be prepared to learn.
Carrie in Baltimore, we hear you loud and clear. Carrie in Baltimore saying these foundations and their reports are rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. You're barely scratching the surface of the problem.
I appreciate the comment. The first thing I want to say is if anyone's hearing anything in our report or what I'm saying today that is critical of teachers or unions, that's not our intention. We hear over and over again how important and critical teachers are to everything that's happening inside of schools. I also would say I agree that the issues of poverty affect everything that happens inside our schools. Our schools are where all of the issues of poverty converge in one place. And I guess that my response would be is that I don't see these issues as mutually exclusive. We should be working on all of the issues related to poverty, hunger, trauma, mental health, housing instability, and we should be working to make sure that every school inside Baltimore City Public Schools is a great one.
Let me change the subject here briefly and go around the table. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, I ultimately want to end with you. I want to talk about, say a student makes a school choice decision. They get their first choice. It's the school they wanted to go to, and it's across town. So once the choice is made, what are the challenges for a student who makes the decision to use school choice, go to a school that's far away from where they live? Talk about transportation, talk about adjustment, and we'll start here in the studio. But I know, Nicole, you have some personal stories on this as well. Taylor Stewart, let me start with you.
Sure. So I was a high school teacher when I was in the classroom and had a few students, even though I taught at what was considered a neighborhood school for my kids who were pretty transient. They wanted to stay in the same school, and so they had to make some decisions each day about how they were going to get to school. So I had students who would take two or three buses to be able to get to school, and that meant that their commute could be an hour to an hour and a half to be able to get to the door in time for my class starting at 8:15. And so they would already come in not having the amount of sleep that a student really needs to be able to be successful. Oftentimes then needing breakfast and needing supports there, and oftentimes having a lot of difficulties with truancy and tardiness because our transportation system, if one bus missed its mark on what time it was supposed to arrive, then their entire commute to school was completely shot because they are now waiting on the next bus in that cycle to come, and that has also thrown off their third bus in some of these cases. And so everything has to go right every single morning for a lot of kids who are doing commutes across our school, and we just do not have the transportation system in Baltimore at this time to, even though it's not a massive city, but to accommodate especially students from East and West Baltimore who don't have a ton of transportation options to be able to get across the city to where a lot of programs are located.
The Teacher's Eye View from Taylor Stewart, Regional Director in Baltimore at Leadership for Educational Equity. Roger Schulman of Fund for Educational Excellence, you spoke with 400-some-odd students and their parents. What did you hear from students who had made their choice and, you know, as far as adjustments? We've heard about transportation. What other adjustments need to be taken into consideration?
We heard some interesting things about this because one of the things we know is that students are traveling, as Taylor said, a long way to get to their school, and they are passing two or three schools to get to the one they want to go to. So families are choosing schools based on a lot on relationships. Their cousin went there or their uncle went there, or the family believes it's in a safer neighborhood than the school that is closest to them. And so that is driving a lot of the decisions that families are making, or at least from the 418 people we heard from. What Taylor brings up, though, is very, very important. That transportation becomes a barrier, and it leads to big attendance issues and to a transfer problem. And when kids want to transfer, we heard this a lot as well from kids and families, it becomes a very complicated process to transfer within the choice system. And again, that's another place where it is hard for families to navigate that process, to understand what they need to do to transfer to another school.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, we're getting close to the end of our hour, but we've got about 2 minutes left. I wonder if you might maybe conclude here for us by telling us your own story of your own childhood and your own experience with busing.
Sure. I was part of a voluntary desegregation plan in my hometown. I grew up in the Midwest. And starting in second grade, I began riding a bus for 2 hours a day to a majority white school on the other side of town that my parents believed would get me a better education. The problem with all of this is it's very taxing on students to spend that much time on buses. One shouldn't have to leave your neighborhood in order to get access to a quality education. It makes it much harder for parents to be involved. One of the things that I hear all the time when parents choose what they consider to be a less rigorous school for their child, it's because they feel they need to be able to get to their child if something happens, or it's too difficult to get to a school in order to be able to participate in activities with their child. So I think we've built a system that is incredibly unequal and makes the lives of people who are already disadvantaged even more so. If I could quickly just answer what the caller said about focusing on the wrong things.
Sure. In about 30 seconds or so.
Yes,
go ahead.
We need a comprehensive approach, but what schools can control, they need to control. And schools should not be exacerbating the inequality and disadvantage that already exists in our society, and they do.
Nicole Hannah-Jones has been on the line with us from the Manhattan studio of the New York Times. She is a staff writer for the Times Magazine. She has written very powerfully about race and opportunity in America's public schools and about the roots and consequences of de facto school segregation in her own Brooklyn neighborhood. Her story, Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City, appeared in the New York Times Magazine. That story has earned her the Hillman Prize for Magazine Journalism. We'll have a link to that on our website. We can also link to Nicole Hannah-Jones' Peabody Award-winning series on school segregation for the radio program This American Life. Thank you, Nicole. I also want to say thank you to Taylor Stewart, working as a teacher and advocate for academic equity in schools in Baltimore and across the state for the past 10 years. She is now Baltimore Regional Director at Leadership for Educational Equity, a nonprofit education policy group. Thanks also to Roger Schulman, former executive director of Teach for America and currently serving as president and CEO of the Fund for Educational Excellence. The Baltimore nonprofit's new report is called Calculated Choices, Equity and Opportunity in Baltimore City Public Schools. And we'll have a link to that on the website as well, wypr.org/midday. Coming up tomorrow on Midday, The continuing controversy over genetically modified foods and the radical changes they've brought to the American food industry and to the dietary choices we make every day. Environmental writer and journalism professor McKay Jenkins is the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. He's going to join our guest host Rob Sivak for the hour and take your comments and questions tomorrow here on Midday. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, and thank you also to the Diz for providing lunch for our guests. Stay tuned for Here and Now coming up right after the news. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. Have a great day.